Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with how local lawmakers are responding to events unfolding in Ukraine. Our focus, Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Trahan joined a bipartisan delegation of U.S. lawmakers who toured the area near the Ukrainian border in Poland, Romania, Moldova late last month. They spoke with military leaders, met with refugees, and with organizations working with people who are continuing to flood into neighboring countries to escape the violence. Since returning, Trahan has rattled some cages about the response, including pressing oil executives about gas prices and their response to the Russian invasion. Congresswoman Trahan represents Massachusetts' 3rd Congressional District. That includes Lawrence, Lowell, Fitchburg. She is on the line now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Congresswoman.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tiziana.
So a couple weeks ago, you're back from the border of Ukraine. That is a long way from Massachusetts' 3rd District. Why did you go?
So I think first and foremost, Vladimir Putin has managed to do what pretty much no other person has. He's rallied almost the entire world and most Democrats and Republicans against him. Certainly his attempt to rebuild the Soviet Union by invading Ukraine without provocation has brought swift and severe consequences for himself and his inner circle and the Russian people. And the sanctions that we've levied in partnership with our allies have, you know, decimated the Russian economy. They've reduced the value of the ruble to almost nothing. And we've built upon that by providing substantial lethal and humanitarian aid. But that is why I traveled to the Ukrainian border a few weeks ago with Congressman Stephen Lynch to meet with the Ukrainian refugees that we've mobilized to assist and to reassure our NATO allies that they have the full support of the United States should Vladimir Putin even think he can target them next.
Congresswoman, what was the most striking moment of the trip for you? Take us to that moment.
Well, certainly anytime that you have the chance to go to the border and talk directly to Ukrainian people who are fleeing their homes, they're leaving their families, they're actually separating from their families in real time, is something that will just stay with you for a lifetime. I mean, to see families say goodbye to their dads and to their brothers as, you know, part of the family walked across the border to safety and the men turned around to go fight. You know, I'm a mom of 2 young daughters. Those memories are just, they're singed on my brain. And I think that it's an unbelievable show of will that the Ukrainian people have showed, but it doesn't come without unbelievable cost, and despair for the folks that are left behind. And so those images have only gotten worse in the weeks that I've been home. I mean, to see the images we've seen out of Bucha and Kramatorsk and other liberated, you know, Ukrainian communities, they're horrific. Clearly an escalation from what we saw and heard on the ground just a few weeks ago.
So
I think, yeah, go ahead.
Well, so I want to stay in that for a minute, but obviously you went with some things in mind. You have been now witness to and present in a moment where history is really happening, and you are a public servant. Did you come back with any changes in your priorities? And I'm not poking for, you know, oh, what's different. I mean, that does change a person. So how has your policy mindset shifted, if at all, coming back from something like that?
Yeah, well, this war has had consequences that many of us could never fathom. But our bipartisan delegation also strengthened my belief that, you know, Vladimir Putin greatly underestimated the strength and the willpower of the Ukrainian people. He also underestimated U.S. leadership and our ability to strengthen NATO and to respond. Look, the slaughter of innocent Ukrainian civilians is a heinous crime against humanity. And Vladimir Putin, his commanders, his armed forces that carried out these war crimes, they are all responsible. And so I think last week when the House voted to require that the U.S. government do everything possible to collect and share the evidence necessary to prosecute Russian war criminals, it was an important step and one that, we're going to continue this pressure, whether it's on sanctions, supplying lethal aid, putting ourselves in position so that we can hold war criminals accountable. And I think the important thing is that we do that in concert with our allies because, as the sanctions have showed, the compounding effect of working in concert with our European allies has been really what strengthened them.
You've shined a pretty strong light on companies and their responsibilities. You know, April 6th, executives from six big oil companies testified before Congress. You came down hard on executives from Shell and Pioneer Resources for buying Russian oil since the beginning of the invasion, for the sale of stocks. You know, over the weekend, the Boston Herald reports that Boston-based Gillette is still doing business in Russia. They make up about 70% of the country's shaving industry. Are you putting pressure on Gillette to withdraw? And what else are you doing as a congressperson to push businesses to not participate, given the priorities you've just laid out?
Well, certainly Congress has taken some pretty bold action in banning energy products, oil, gas, other energy products from Russia. And I think, though, the world is sort of demanding folks to follow suit. I mean, we've seen everyone from regular Americans dumping out their Russian vodka to small businesses taking it off their shelves. And I think there is an activist sort of culture in our country. They want to know what businesses are doing business with Russia, what businesses are okay with giving money to this war criminal. And I think it's in a really important inflection point for CEOs and executives to think about. I spent my time, because I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee, last week talking to some of the leaders of America's largest oil companies to explain to the American people why, despite the price of oil starting to come down, that their home heating bills haven't and their gas prices haven't. And we did hear a lot of lip service from those CEOs during the hearing about why they aren't responsible for gas prices. But what they conveniently left out of those responses is how much they've been touting those prices to their shareholders. And that's because they're making a lot of money. In some cases,
how do you deal with
setting profits?
How do you deal with that conflict of interest, essentially?
I think that we do have to shine a spotlight on the fact that manipulating supply at this moment when gas prices are so high is not, it's not okay. This notion that the government should be issuing more permits so that, these oil executives can increase supply, it's a false start. It's not even accurate. They have the permits they need. They could execute on them tomorrow. They're choosing not to because they're engaged in, stock buybacks and these incredible dividends, and in some cases, even cashing in themselves and profiteering off this war and this pandemic recovery. And so I think we have to make sure that we're holding our oil and gas companies accountable. And I think there are a few policy prescriptions that are being discussed right now in terms of what we do if they don't do the right thing on their own by lowering gas prices.
All right. We have about a minute left. So just briefly, you supported the Relief for Restaurants and Other Hard-Hit Small Businesses Act last mm-hmm. week, $55 billion replenishing help for restaurants, other businesses. The National Restaurant Association says that only one in three restaurants last time got help. And a lot of businesses were just disenfranchised from the banking system and financial systems that would have helped them. You thinking this time around, is Congress making sure that all those little restaurants are going to be able to take advantage of these new dollars?
Yes. We did learn a lot of lessons about the relief that we gave to our small businesses, and our restaurants in particular. These are the heart of our communities. But there are also some of the organizations that were hit hardest by the pandemic. And recovering and rebuilding from, the economic effects of the pandemic means making sure that these establishments aren't left behind. But right now, a lot of, restaurants rightly feel that way. Here in Massachusetts alone, one in every three across the Commonwealth that applied for relief through the Restaurant Revitalization Fund received it. And this critical relief helped them keep their doors open and their employees on staff. But because it ran out of funds so quickly with the high demand, many restaurants are still hanging on by a thread. So that's why it's so important to replenish this fund.
Congresswoman Lori Trahan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back after a break. This is Radio Boston. We're going to talk about liquor licenses in the city of Boston now because, as it turns out, they're governed differently there than any other place in Massachusetts and by a law dating back to the 1930s that was focused on keeping Boston residents from drinking too much. The legacy of all that today, two big problems. First, most liquor licenses are like taxicab medallions, and they're held and sold privately and often for exorbitant amounts of money. Think, you know, $300,000 or more. Second, Boston's black and brown neighborhoods disproportionately don't have them. Hyde Park has 26, Mattapan has 10, South Boston, 62. That makes it hard for new restaurants, great new chefs, new cuisine to make it onto the map and means neighborhoods are underexplored by foodies and underserved by local small establishments. The Boston City Council wants to fix it. With us now, Ruth Z. Lujan. She's now a new at-large Boston City Councilor, co-sponsoring legislation that could add 200 neighborhood-specific liquor licenses in the city, and Nia Grace. Nia owns Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in Roxbury. She's also the co-founder of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. Councilor, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Tiziana, and wonderful job on the name pronunciation there. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Nia, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Nia, I'm actually going to start with you. How did you get your liquor license? Tell us that story.
I was able to purchase my liquor license directly from the seller of the restaurant. He had the license with the business, and it was included in the sale.
And, Counselor, that's not enough, right?
No, it's not. I'm really grateful that Nia was able to purchase a license. Daryl's is one of my favorite restaurants here in the city of Boston. We, unfortunately, in too many of our neighborhoods, especially our black and brown neighborhoods, we don't have enough licenses and there's not a lot of availability on the open market, on the secondary market. And even where there is, they can often be cost prohibitive for so many of our restaurateurs, for new entrepreneurs, especially our black and brown ones that may not have access to capital to purchase licenses. So that's the impetus behind these two home rule petitions that I filed to get more liquor licenses into our communities.
So Nia, bring this home. As a business owner, right, what does it mean to have a liquor license, to not have a liquor license, to have it be prohibitively expensive potentially to get one on the private market?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is just the economics. When you have a liquor license in your restaurant establishment or food and beverage establishment, you're able to see at least a 25% more in terms of income on every check that is coming through. And that's additional income where, in fact, the margins on alcohol is much better than on food. So we're already talking about the ability to earn more. And that's what we want to be able to do. So in terms of actually getting to the licensing, although it was a part of my sale, it was something that I had desired for about 10 years and thought, and in fact, didn't feel that I could get into the space. And only after working for someone was I able to get that close to it.
So, and Councilor Lujan, what are the hidden costs of this structure where, really, to put it probably overly bluntly, you've got some transferable licenses, which means people sell them to other people, which means you got to be in that network, you got to have the cash, you got to know the right people and be in the right place at the right time. What else is hidden that's lost when the system works like that and aspiring small business owners, restaurateurs can't get a hold of this piece that would make such a critical difference to their business?
Well, Tiziana, I think what you said is just right. There's often an asymmetry of information, right? So yeah, who you know, who you, whether you have access to capital to help you underwrite the cost of that license. And, you know, the hidden cost often is for residents, folks like me. I live in Hyde Park, straddle the Mattapan Hyde Park line, and it is difficult for me in the evening to find a restaurant in my neighborhood that I can frequent that has a liquor license. And we know that it spurs a lot of economic development and can be our restaurants and small businesses are the engines to our local economy that hire folks in the neighborhood. So the hidden costs of not having restaurants with liquor license in our neighborhoods are, you know, more struggling neighborhoods. And so I think with these transferable licenses, with these non-transferable licenses, but one for the four that proposed for the bowling building in Roxbury and the 200 proposed for some of the neighborhoods in Boston that lack them the most and that also happen to be our Black and Brown neighborhoods. It's providing a window into an otherwise and often very complicated, often very narrow, and as you stated, very antiquated system of accessing liquor licenses in the city of Boston.
Okay, so for our listeners to understand, basically, and Nia, I'm making eye contact with you here so you can be like, uh-uh, if I've got any part of this wrong. Basically, the state government, legislature, controls authorization of cities, like of Boston, to issue liquor licenses. Yep. Most of them have been, and we're talking a little more than 1,000, most of them have been transferable, meaning once somebody owns them, they kind of own them like property, like a cab medallion, they can sell them. It is possible to create liquor licenses that, one, are restricted to particular neighborhoods, and two, when the business goes away, goes back to the state, it can be reissued. That is what this home rule petition is that the councilor's working on. What would that mean in communities in Boston for the restaurant scene, for small business owners to have these new 200 restricted to neighborhoods, they revert when you're done with them, licenses?
I mean, at its basic level, it's going to allow them to remain competitive in a very, very competitive market, just to start. We're going to reduce at least $500,000 in fees in order to obtain the attorneys. And then it's going to allow them, like I said, just an ability to stay competitive as well as increase their overall income. When we now add liquor licenses, and that means you have to do, staffing that might be tip staff or even, you know, whatever the wages are, but it allows more people to earn. It gives more of an opportunity as opposed to just being in counter service and you only need a few people. Now you're able to maybe hire a few dozen people. I mean, and then allows people to really have a neighborhood that thrives. Right now, we do take a lot of our income out of our immediate neighborhoods where we go and rest our head and bring it to other neighborhoods. And while that's fine because we're all one Boston, it would be great if I can have that same experience down the street from my house.
Well, yeah, be able to walk to a neighborhood restaurant at the end of a long day and sit there with your partner or friend, have a drink, relax, chill out. It's kind of mind-boggling that there are a lot of communities in Boston where you basically can't do that right now.
Yeah, it is. When we talked about the vibrancy, or matter of fact, you talked about the sheer amount in South Boston of licenses. It's
62.
The same thing when you think about it with the North End. The vibrancy of those neighborhoods are really unparalleled throughout the city.
So, Counselor, I'll come back to you. And just for listeners, we are having a conversation here on Radio Boston with Nia Grace, a local restaurant owner, and a new Boston City Council member, Ruth Z. Louis-Jean, about a move to get 200 additional liquor licenses into the city of Boston, restricted to particular neighborhoods. Not the first time. So back in 2014, when Ayanna Pressley was a Boston City Councilor, worked with Mayor Marty Walsh, there were about 150 issued. That really did drive down the cost, but they also got used up really fast. So you're pushing for 200 here specifically, and then, as I understand it, essentially another increase by 10% over 10 years. Is it enough? Is it? It's more than enough. It's just all we can get. Talk about that volume and the need.
Well, we'll see. I think this is a really great place to start. I think a lot of folks, a lot of past electeds, a lot of people are interested in liquor license reform in general. For us to have more municipal city control over doling out liquor licenses, that we have to go and petition the state house whenever we want an increase because of the hard cap we have, is not a good system. And it is a relic of antiquated discriminatory practices against, frankly, working class Irish folks here in the city of Boston. And so what this seeks to do, this petition that I filed, sponsored by my colleague, Brian Worrell, who represents, let me say, the poorest district in Boston, which is large swaths of Mattapan and Dorchester. It is to make sure that we are getting economic drivers into our neighborhoods. And we can talk about what the 200 looks like. We can talk about spacing out the 200 non-transferable licenses over time so that we don't flood the market with these licenses, and make sure that we're also providing technical assistance to entrepreneurs and business owners so that they also know how to, so that, you know, no one is just sitting on this license when they get it, so that they know how to operationalize it. But I think it's important that you noted in 2014, after then city councilor, now Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, really pushed for these non-transferable licenses, we didn't see a negative impact on the value of the transferable licenses, which is, I think, something that restaurant owners may worry about, that the value of these licenses, which I think right now are somewhere, you know, upwards of $450 to $500,000 to buy a transferable license on the private market. What we saw with the issuance of the 75 non-transferable ones in 2014 was the price of the transferable licenses actually continued to increase.
Yeah, let's check in.
No negative impact.
Let's check in with Nia on that in our limited time here. You have one of those transferable licenses. I'm assuming it cost you a pretty penny.
It did.
Are you worried?
I'm not personally concerned, and I wouldn't say that I may not share in some of the concerns of my peers. I just think that there is more room for additional license holders in the market, especially within our communities that, you know, have a drastic, almost none in comparison. You know, we have, in terms of license holders in general, especially those of people of color, I think it's less than 1.5% who own licenses at all. And so, and I just think it's a way for us to address economic barriers. And so for me personally, I'm not against it. I do think there's probably some massaging that needs to be done with the petition. But I think it's a really great way to have the conversation started.
All right. And there, that is Nia Grace, owner of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in Roxbury, co-founder of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And Boston City Councilor Ruth Z. Louisgen, who is co-sponsoring legislation to try to add more licenses in the city. Councilor, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk with you again.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana, and nice to hear from you, Nia.
Hey, Ruth.
John Denver made it sound so easy.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Inch by inch. Okay, fair enough, John Denver, national treasure, but I don't know about you, not my experience. You got sun to deal with, shade, rabbits, rain, grubs. Maybe it gets colder at night. And then there's the window garden with its own set of challenges. So let's talk gardening. The sun's shining down. The temperatures are starting to climb. We want to bring you some expert advice. Call or tweet with your gardening questions. The tweet is at Radio Boston. The call, here's the number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your gardening questions. Here with us in Studio 3, Patrick Parent. He is a product line manager at Mahoney's Garden Centers and host of the Paul Parent Garden Club, a gardening show started by his father 54 years ago and carried on. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we're going to cover a lot of ground today. No pun, okay, pun totally intended. But I wanted to starting by asking you, is it time to start planting? And if you haven't started planting yet, is it already like, oh no, I'm too late?
You're never too late to start when it comes to gardening. You know, right now, we are actually technically a little early when it comes to a few things. We can start getting a few of our items, like our cold crops, you know, your lettuces, your kales, your broccoli, your cauliflower, the loved Brussels sprouts,
mm-hmm.
right? Those things can be started at this time. And we could be starting... you know, you could be planting your flowers when it comes to your shrubs and trees. We're not going towards the annuals yet.
Yep.
The annuals, you know, the ones that they flower just for the season, then they're gone.
Yep.
Still too cold.
A little too soon for that. All right. And cold crops, I'm assuming, literally mean crops you can plant while it's still cold out.
Pretty much. It is that idea behind it. Makes it a little bit easy for us to understand.
Yep.
But they're ones that are a little bit more cold hardy,
mm-hmm.
cold tolerant. And like Brussels sprouts, for example, those can go all the way till Christmas.
Okay. And you can plant those outside starting now.
Of course.
All right. Now, is there anything, let's say one either likes to start seedlings inside or plans to grow inside or in a window box, let's say, for the entire season, what should you be starting now or could you be starting now in that case?
Well, actually, you could be starting the majority of your vegetables that you would have outside. You can start inside. This is actually a perfect time of year to be doing that. You look at when it comes to seeding and how long it takes to germinate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for an example, a tomato. Tomato can take anywhere between 90 and 120 days to germinate.
That is a long time.
Exactly. So if you're starting...
It takes me 2 seconds to eat the tomato when it comes.
But if you think about that time frame and then think about when we actually can put those outside, which is, to be honest with you, it's about May 20th.
Okay.
If you were to put 120 days from then starting, we're talking September. We don't want to enjoy our tomatoes in September. We want to enjoy them in August and prior. So they actually, to start some of those seeds, should have been about 2-3 weeks ago getting ready. You can start all your annuals, perennials, seed annuals, seed perennials can be started indoors. You know, if you want to put some flowers outside, pansies right now are perfect. Dusty Miller, which is more of a foliage, but it's got that gray tint to it that looks great with the pansies together. You know, not a lot of other things just yet. The weather has just been so up and down. I mean, whoever got Mother Nature angry, we need to have a conversation because I'll tell you, I've had enough of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it has, we've had some sort of precipitation every weekend this year so far.
Wow. And so, what does that do to plants?
Well, so the plants just have no idea what day it is.
Yeah.
Right now. I mean, they know, they see the warm weather. We had warm weather about a month ago. The soil temperatures warmed up. Everybody was all excited. Plants were starting to warm up. And then we had snow. And the plants started to slow down. And long-term health effects of a plant can actually hurt them. You know, your bloom period cannot be as long. The flowers might not be as big, might not have as much. You know, when a plant is starting to show buds early, has a cold snap, something happens to it, those buds might not form fully, which means you might not get flowers. You might not get everything.
So we're talking with Patrick Parent. He's a product line manager at Mahoney's Garden Centers about spring planting and flowers and vegetables and gardening. We're taking your questions on Twitter at Radio Boston and on the phone 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Teresa Hutchinson on Twitter says, at Radio Boston, is it too soon to start weeding the gardening beds? And Teresa, good for you that you weed. I'll start there. But Patrick, is it too soon to do that? Should you leave that stuff in place as ground cover for now?
At this point, I would get rid of it.
Okay. You know, why?
You know, the weeds are only going to take away anything that you put into the soil. You know, if you start right now, you're putting compost into a vegetable garden to add for the year. Well, those weeds are going to start to thrive off it. They're going to pull the nutrients from it. You start to fertilize anything, weeds are going to take that. Why take care of something that you don't want there, right? And weeds are one of those things.
So what about for a new gardener who maybe has not tended their garden in a yard before or has, plants in pots and little things sprout up and they're not sure if they're good or bad? How do you decide what to pull?
Well, so if you look at the definition of a weed, it is an unwanted plant.
So anything you don't want.
So anything you don't want. So, I mean, you could be looking at something, you know, like a marigold that you might not want. That's a weed to you.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's not as easy as just saying this is a weed and this is not. You kind of have to let it go. When they start to get viney or they start to spread out a little bit quickly instead of actually the sprouts and looking like what you put in there for seeds, you should be, you know, pulling out some of those things that are on the sides there. But depending upon, you know, where it is, where it's been, did you leave compost over there? Did you mulch over the winter? Did you put leaves over the winter? What did you do? Those are all things that can factor in what can be there. Because a lot of weeds are wind blown.
I see.
So it's not like, you know, it's just from one spot.
Right.
You know, your neighbor could have done a great job cleaning the yard, pushing all the leaves into the woods, but it's right next to your house. Now you have all
and
his
here
weeds.
Here it comes. All right. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK to ask a question. And we have Karen on the line. How do you get your soil ready? Do you need to use compost or fertilizer? Tell us.
Well, so to get your soil ready, you know, we always think about taking care of the grass or the plants above it. But the soil is actually just as important. Soil, knowing the levels of different nutrients that are in there, are the way that your plants will grow healthier and stronger. So putting compost, putting peat moss, putting any type of material that is organic really helps just wake everything up.
What about coffee grounds? I've heard that before. I've seen people get old bags of coffee grounds from a local coffee house.
You can put coffee grounds in there. A lot of people will actually put them, I've heard people put them in roses, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people now will put them into their compost and mix it into that to have a little bit more. It's got a little bit of nitrogen in it. It's not going to change the levels dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's one of the things you can do. You can take wood ash from the stove from the winter. If you clean out the wood stove every, you know, couple weeks and you store it, you can put that right over the
garden.
Wait,
all those
garden.
Ashes from the fireplace you can put into the garden to amend the soil? I did not know that.
So you can actually put that right over the top. You're not doing it all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can do that in the spring. It's got potassium. It's got phosphorus in it. It's got some of those different things from nature that we're taking back and putting into the soil, and that will really help it.
Okay, so I want to talk about something that's going to make me sound like a grumpy bad person. Rabbits, right? Which are adorable and plentiful and eat things, whether it's the cold crops, the lettuce, tulips. I mean, how many people have tulips that they're trying to grow and just as it starts to come up, munch, 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 and they're gone. How do you deter the rabbits? Or are we supposed to embrace them in their full rabbitiness?
Well, so what I will usually tell somebody the first thing when they come up, I'll just look them right in the face and say, you just got to move.
Great.
But to be honest with you, there is a product out there that I have found in the past couple of years that is absolutely incredible. It's called Rabbit Scram.
Yeah.
This is a product that is granular. You bring it around the areas. It's got dried blood in it, right? It's the excess from bovine that is used.
That is dark.
And it is, but the idea is the smell deters them. The thing about this product is a lot of your repellents, when it gets wet, you have to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
All the liquid forms, you have to spray every time it rains. And it's been raining every day.
Right.
This product, when it gets wet, it actually makes it stronger.
Okay.
And it actually works even longer. So this product called Rabbit Scram is one of the best products I've ever seen. Gentleman I work with actually watched rabbits run towards those plants where he had used it and then run the opposite way as soon as they got close enough.
All right. So before we go, I want to talk. I just love it that there's this radio broadcast that your father, Paul Parent, started 54 years ago. You have carried it forward. Did you garden with your dad when you were a kid?
Yeah, I've been in this industry since I was 6 years old. My family owned a nursery and garden center
Wow.
in Maine for a long time. When my father passed in 2018, you know, we weren't sure what we were going to do. And immediately I said, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And the next week I took over and just been doing everything that he was doing. I kept all of his commercials that were live on there. So it's still part of the show. We still do everything. It's question and answer for 4 hours, and it's nationwide, which is the crazy thing.
How have you kept the love of gardening for yourself when you started in this industry at 6 years old?
You know, I honestly think of my dad. That's what I do. I mean, I think of what he would do and how much fun he had doing it and how he brought us up. And I got to spend time with him in the garden center. That's what we did.
Yeah.
We got to hang out with him. So, I mean, I'll tell you that. Every time I do anything, or if I'm having a bad day with this, I kind of think about what he would do, and I'm all right.
And do you have a plan, too, or do you now pass gardening on in your family?
Well, I've got a 6 and a 4-year-old, and they are interested for, you know, a certain amount of time. They can only be
right.
so interested, but they love it. They love hearing about it. They made my wife turn the radio on yesterday so they could hear me.
That's great.
It was amazing. So,
all right. Patrick Parent, product line manager at Mahoney's Garden Centers, host of the Paul Parent Garden Club, a gardening show started by his father 54 years ago. Patrick, thanks for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you tuned in on this Monday. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.